This is a podcast from ABC Overnights.
Austin is a maths teacher turned filmmaker, and he's also the curator of the Adventure Travel Film Festival. Hello.
Hello there. Hello, Australia.
Yeah, now you are calling from sunny London, is it?
I certainly am, yeah.
Is it sunny?
No, it's awful. You're just taunting me.
It's very sunny here, you know. It's
I know it is. I know. That's enough. Can we get to the first question, please?
Let's get straight to it. I did have a text, actually, that came through that said, Mass, ooh, can't think of a more depressing job. I take a year leave as well. I don't blame him. Let's go to your Mass days. What made you decide to take that year off?
I think it was that natural thing that if you, for whatever reason, fall into riding motorcycles, which I did as a kind of teenager in my late teens, early 20s. I had an elder brother, he got me into motorbikes. And once I'd been whizzing around a bit around London and the southeast of England and stuff, I couldn't help but think that this was the tool to have an adventure on. And so while I was in my 20s, me and some friends cooked up this idea of trying to go around the world on motorbikes. And back then, and I'm talking about the early 90s, back then, the Soviet Union had just opened up, and there was this yawning chasm of this enormous amount of land that it sounded like it might be possible to drive all the way across and get to Vladivostok, you know, over by Japan. And so that was our idea, and it went from there, really.
Your first motorbike, can you describe it for me?
Oh, no, it was a crappy East German motorbike made by a company called MZ. And because it was made under communist conditions, it was insanely cheap in England in the 70s and 80s. So if you were poor, but you wanted quite a new motorbike, you could buy one of these East German MZs, and it was hopeless. It was so unreliable and useless. I would have been much better off just getting a bicycle.
What did it look like?
Now, of course, it's regarded as the height of postmodern ironic kitsch because it's very, very unstylish. It was completely functional. The tank was like a cube that had been made by somebody doing a sixth form science or technology welding project. So it was very ugly and very uncool.
Very ugly and very uncool, but it became your bike.
Like myself, Lisa, actually.
well, so you worked as a maths teacher, and then you felt the north wind blowing, or at least a wind from a different direction, and decided that you'd take some time off with your mates. But it's not very easy for a bunch of fellas. Some of you had partners, a lot of you had jobs, some in school, some in finance. I mean, how do you actually manage to mobilise everyone to actually get together and take that time off?
Well, there were two key things that made the project come to fruition. One is that we were all in our 20s, and none of us were actually married. And when we put the idea together in December 1992, none of us even had girlfriends. So we were like proper cast iron losers, and so none of us had mortgages either, so we just had our jobs and a purely disposable income, and dare I say it, you know, no responsibilities to anybody except ourselves, so we could act selfishly. And so we met up in the town of Nottingham in the north of England in December 92, and we came from all corners of the country. This was a list of all the friends I had who could ride motorbikes. It was eight people. And we kicked about this idea of doing a big trip. And amazingly, we set a date for 2.5 years later. And we said, right, we're going to leave then. We're going to leave in April 95. And amazingly, we did. And of the eight guys that were at that meeting, seven of them made it to the start line and did actually do the trip.
How did you finance it?
Well, just saved a bit and then borrowed loads. It's very cheap. That's the other myth, is that motorcycling around the world, when you're rough camping and south catering the whole time, is incredibly cheap, and it's certainly much cheaper than living in London. So the amount of money you need is a fraction of what you think you will need.
And that trip you went on became the project Mondo Enduro, and you actually took along a camera as well.
Yeah, I was back in the early 90s, I was inspired by an Australian, by an English filmmaker who now lives in Australia. His name is Josh Collins. So if the listeners could Google him, he opened an amazing bar in Melbourne called Lou Wow. And so that's the Australian connection. But he was making films in London in the early 90s with a Super 8 camera, an old kind of 1970s cine camera. And I kind of fell into his orbit and was drawn towards him. And I loved his DIY filmmaking approach. He didn't worry about the fact that he didn't have any filmmaking credentials. He made a lot of short films that were pretty wacky and very arty and rock and roll and cool. So I was inspired by him, and I used to shoot a lot of Super 8. But of course, it was silent, and it was very expensive, relatively expensive. And back then, in the early 90s, Sony invented a format of camera which is called High 8. So any video technicians listening will know what that was. But it was a breakthrough increase in video camera quality and resolution. And this camera that Sony invented was the first time what they call a broadcast quality camera had been released onto the high street to be sold, you know, through normal shops. And it was called the Sony VX1. And the BBC, who had very strict quality control guidelines, said that for the first time ever, they would accept any program that was made on High 8. Whereas before that, the video cameras weren't good enough resolution. So that was the breakthrough. So back then, in 95, that camera cost us £2,000. I don't know what that would be in Australian dollars, but it was a phenomenal amount of money. It was the same price as buying one of the new motorbikes.
And so your aim was to get it on the BBC?
Oh, yeah, we tried all that stuff. We failed, didn't we? we spoke to everyone before we left, you know, in the TV community, and because we were members of the public, they didn't care. You know, if one of us had been famous or something, they'd have been all over us. But we were just a load of goons going off on a massive 50,000-mile adventure, which we seemed to be ill-prepared for. So I think people they weren't interested, but also they couldn't, because a program like that had never been made or seen, where members of the public attempted a very long journey like this without any sponsorship or backup. I think a lot of commissioning editors couldn't imagine what the end product would look like. Nor could I, actually, even though I was, you know, notionally the director. It wasn't until we got back and having shot it that I realized how cool, you know, that it was going to be an amazing film. And we ultimately got it commissioned by the Discovery Channel in Europe, and that was like a real coup, because, you know, it was odd back then, 20 years ago, for a load of ordinary people with no film school or TV connections to get what was essentially their home movie put on television. But it happened, and then the DVD thing happened, and it came out as a DVD, and it, in the motorcycle community, very quickly achieved a cult reputation. And there was nothing like it until actually I did a sequel to it called Terra Circa. And now, 20 years later, it's sort of taken on a life of its own. It's extraordinary. I can't believe I'm being interviewed about it. I mean, it's like, it's 20 years ago.
If somebody had come back to me
from the future in 1995 and said, this film is going to be world famous in its field, 20 years from now, I'd have burst out laughing.
If only Marty McFly came to you and told you that information. Here's a little bit of that of that film.
Yeah.
If we'd known then what we know now, we might never have set off. The crashes, the incessant punctures, the miles and miles of mud, the horrific accidents, 42,000 miles around the world in a motorcycle, to be joking.
It was a big adventure. I would love to hear some of the tales of that. In fact, there's a question for you wanting to know, was it about motorcycles or travelling or a combination of the two, the thing that made you want to go and take out, you know, go on that road and take that adventure?
It was both simultaneously. As I alluded to before, I don't think that there's many people who ride motorcycles who think it's just a two-wheeled car. You think it's just a way of getting from A to B. It is for some people, but you know, there's something about it. Dare I liken it to riding a horse, or maybe even being in a really, really cheap helicopter? That's what I think of it as. And it's just, you know, there's an entire culture built around the fact that riding a motorcycle is definitely more exciting than driving a car. And so that is, you've got that, and then you've got the fact that we were all kind of young, free, and single, and thought, wouldn't it be great to kind of like just get out there and see what the world has to offer instead of just doing what all of our friends are doing, which is, you know, birth, school, work, death, you know, and working as hard as we could, get a mortgage, get married, you know, have two kids, get an estate car, and then just grind yourself to death on the wheels of the machine.
Warren, the tanker man, has a question for you. Hi, Warren.
G'day, Lisa. G'day, Austin. Mate, I travelled around Europe in 2014 by myself. I'm a mid-50s guy, and I hired a bike in Slovenia and started to travel around Europe. And then there was a typhoon in the Atlantic. So then I had to get out of Central Europe and Western Europe, and I literally headed east. And I got over as far as Romania, and I wanted to actually try and ride into the Ukraine. But what I want to ask you, how much trouble did you have riding through Russia? Was there any issues, like safety-wise and things like that, or what?
It was the opposite. Riding across Russia was pretty much the high point of the trip. The infrastructure is all there. Sometimes it's a bit ropey. It's not what you're used to in the West or where you are in the deep South. But it was the Russian people were so fantastic. The cops and all the militia and the vehicle checkpoints were all absolutely fine. I had one ever so slight, brief kind of brush with the idea of a bent copper. But it was no big deal. But basically, running across Russia was the high point of the trip, and pretty safe and 100% enjoyable. So I recommend, if anyone gets a chance, to attempt that, either going eastwards, you can come and visit us in England, or start in England and then ride your way back
That's what I'm planning on doing in 2018, and I'm sort of looking at getting visas to get into the Ukraine and things like that. But I'm a really keen biker, you know, I do a lot of Ks every year, and I've done the sort of big road trip. I've done 10,000 Ks and went to Romania, and I just had an absolute ball, but I was completely by myself, see, so that's the only thing I was a little bit worried about, you see.
Yeah, you'll
be fine. You'll be fine. There's nothing to it.
Yeah. Well, I had an absolute ball. It was a bit like the TV show Idiot Abroad, because I had no idea. I didn't speak any other than English, and because we're Australian, we talk very fast, so we used to get some people awful confused. But I had an absolute great time, and I was by myself the whole time.
Austin, right. I would think that it's better to travel in a pack.
That's up to you. I would rather you didn't use the word pack, because it does sound like, you know, we were kind of predators. Traveling in a group is, of course, just makes all the administrative side of it easy.
Yeah.
Or easier. Every time there's a problem, it can be split, you know, several ways, or maybe one person can deal with that problem while somebody else goes and finds the embassy, while somebody else goes and buy the food that you're going to eat that night around a campfire. I mean, that makes it a lot easier. But I know a lot of people who are lone wolves type thing, who would much rather be on their own than having to be discussing every decision, or, you know, should we camp here? Should we keep going? It's raining. Should we keep going, or should we hide under that tree? You know, some people don't like to do that kind of discussion. They just want to do their own thing, and that person should travel alone.
Austin Vince is here. He is an adventurer himself and a curator of the Adventure Travel Film Festival, which is coming to Australia, to the town of Bright, next month. Now, Austin, what happened in Turkey?
Well, we had, I think I know what you're alluding to, but it was, what happened actually should be heralded by it being something that went wrong, that was because we listened to other people. The naysayers and the doom-mongers. So in Turkey, we were heading eastwards. We'd just gone across Europe, and we were in Turkey, and we were heading for the Caucasus, for Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan. And we were trying to get to the Azerbaijan port of Baku and then get a boat there across the Caspian Sea to Turkmenistan and then work our way across Central Asia and up into Siberia. And we'd been told by English people who at the Foreign Office that the Caucasus countries were all in a state of meltdown and kind of perpetual freefall through a total breakdown of normal law and order as a result of these countries all suddenly becoming independent from the Soviet Union, and that we would be robbed at gunpoint within yards of entering the country. But not just robbed, it was more serious than that, that the country was so lawless that we would all be murdered, and our motorbikes and our positions all just divvied up by the brigands. So we developed an idea to deal with this, and the first idea was that we wouldn't stop on a single road, ever. And if anybody tried to wave us down, we decided that we wouldn't stop. Then we had a second idea that if we got strung out, like, you know, the little one at the back always gets picked off, don't they? Mm-hmm. So we thought, right, we'll ride as a kind of blob, a really tight blob of 7 motorbikes. So we were practicing this on the coast road of the Black Sea in northern Turkey. We were practicing riding quite fast, like really rather close together in a matrix that was 2x3, with one person at the front as the point. And up in the distance, there was a little kind of shadowy shape, and as we got closer, we realized it was an old woman, bent double by the side of the road, standing on the verge. And just as we approached, she went to step out into the carriageway from the shoulder of the road. And only then did she seem to realize that we were coming. She hadn't looked up at all to see if there was traffic coming. She looked up, saw that there was this kind of squad of bikes barreling down her, and instead of retreating back to the curb, as maybe a rabbit might or something, something in her 80-year-old brain said, "Oh, I'm going to go for it." And she went as fast as an 80-year-old woman could to try and cross the road, but she timed it so perfectly that we just smashed straight into her. And two motorbikes went straight into this old woman in the middle of the carriageway.
Oh my goodness!
Of course, we didn't anticipate this, because as we saw her, we were thinking, well, there's no way that person is going to run out in front of you. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, it's only when an animal runs out in front of you that you know what it's like. Humans tend not to do it. And so two bikes smashed into her, and then they crashed, and then all the other bikes crashed into them. And we ended up in literally a 7-bike pile-up on the side of the road with a load of us injured. She was smashed to bits. And and blood and everything all over the place, and bits of luggage. And so we'd only been on the road for like 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks, so we were kind of greenhorns. We had not expected something like this at all. So we stopped the next car that came past, and it was a member of the public. He didn't really know what happened, but he could see the damage. So we bundled the old woman's almost skeletal physique. She must have weighed about, 30 kilos, it was, or less. Mm. We put her in the back of this car, and me and another guy jumped in the car as well, and this bloke sped off to the local emergency room, which was a few miles away. And then from there, we got taken to another emergency room in an actual, quite a big town called Riez in northern Turkey. And that town, that hospital, had its own policeman who was on permanent duty there. So there was quite a hoo-ha, and the Turkish bloke who'd been driving the car, told the policeman what had happened as the woman was taken away on a stretcher. I think what he said is, "These guys have all just ridden over this woman," which of course was true, but I think he must have said it in such a way that it sounded like we'd done it on purpose. Or something. Anyway, so we were like immediately arrested in the hospital, and then they unfolded an entire episode that we thought, of course, was going to turn into our motorcycle version of Midnight Express, and luckily it didn't. But it took all day and the most phenomenal set of acting and miming. Do you play that game charades in Australia?
Yeah.
Do you call it that?
Yeah.
At Christmas. So I had to play charades, and the stake was my life or my freedom. And me and the other guy acted out it took about half an hour. We had the entire emergency room as our audience eventually, but we acted out the scenario of what had just happened. And everyone kind of became quite entertained by it, and everyone kind of calmed down. We thought, phew, we've told the truth, we didn't do anything wrong, it's just an accident, it's one of those things. And I think she was just, very old. And
was she okay?
I didn't
realise that that's how you guys ended in that situation. I mean, did she get out of it okay?
I thought she was going to die immediately or within an hour of the impact. It was horrific. For some reason, I don't know if it was her clothes or something, or maybe it was two glancing blows, but it sounded like she was alive. And then somebody came from out of the ward with a very stern face, and they had a piece of paper, which was a transcript of her version of the events. And at the bottom of it wasn't signed, it just had her thumbprint. And by then, somebody had turned up who spoke a tiny, tiny bit of English. He saw his piece of paper, looked at it, read it, And he looked at us and looked at the policeman and he said, you English guys, this old woman says that you were going along the road, she was standing on the shoulder, and that you then all drifted off the road and onto the shoulder, drove down the shoulder and then smashed straight into her while she was standing waiting to cross the road, which is not what happened. So then it all turned sour again and the police got back involved and then we were in a lot of trouble because it looked like we were just, you know, lunatics. Or Hell's Angels, or that, you know, those kind of motorcyclists. And it then took the army then got involved, the military police got involved, who took us all, escorted us all back to the scene of the crash, where some of the guys were still waiting, who'd been sitting there for, like, by then about 8 hours, wondering what on earth had happened to us. And they measured everything and saw all the blood stains and the skid marks were in the middle of the carriageway.
Oh, my God. And this is all in the film.
No, I've seen the film.
Oh, man. Yeah, it makes the cutting room floor. I mean, this just goes to...
It wasn't filmed, that's why. I can't make it. Yeah. In those days, you know, there was no such thing as a GoPro. You couldn't just film your entire journey.
But to me, this makes it seem like it's a quite horrific, rough, dangerous kind of thing to do.
Yeah, but that story I've just related to you, I put it to you, that could have happened in, you know, on the outskirts of Sydney.
Mm. So what do you think people need to do if they want to embark on a big adventure? I mean, you know, it can be fun, but also it can be pretty troublesome as well. I mean, is there a kind of a go-to tip?
Lisa, no more troublesome than real life. You know, giving up your job or getting a leave of absence and going on the road for a year is a million times less stressful than going to work. Than having an alarm go off in the morning and you know what you've got to do. You've got to go and work for the man and you've got to, you know, pay the taxes and the parking tickets and the overdue library bills and then and all the stress of modern Western life. I know you Australians have got, obviously, you think you're the only people in the world who know how to relax. But, but certainly in England, modern professional life is relatively stressful. So being on the road where all you've got to do is get to the next town and then after that, get to the next town after that, and then, you know, eventually get to the end of the continent. That's easy compared to being at work.
Mm-mm. Austin Vince, he's an adventurer and curator of the Adventure Travel Film Festival, which is going to the town of Bright in Victoria. Thank you for your time.